As we talk with John Lee Anderson, we invite you into the conversation. Your questions are welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Anytime during this hour, please feel free to join us. A bit more about our guest, John Lee Anderson has been writing for The New Yorker since 1998 and has covered conflicts in Afghanistan and Angola. He's written profiles of Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, and Saddam Hussein, and has examined the literary influence of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He's the author of several books, including Che Guevara, A Revolutionary Life, and Guerrillas, and is the co-author of War Zones, Voices from the World's Killing Grounds, and Inside the League. His work has also been published in the New York Times Magazine, the New York Times, Harper's, The Nation, Life, The Guardian, Le Monde, Der Spiegel, and many other journals, and he's also been involved with television documentaries on Panama, Bolivia, Guatemala, and Bosnia. And he joins us this morning by telephone. John Lee Anderson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I wanted to ask you to talk about when you first traveled to Iraq before the invasion. Actually, quite some time ago, I believe.
Yes, I mean, in terms of veterans of Iraq, I'm probably a latecomer. I first went there in 2000, but I went there precisely out of a feeling of fascination with a place that had long since lapsed into a kind of mythology. There were certain accepted wisdoms and folklore about Saddam Hussein and about his country, about Iraq, ever since the end of the Gulf War in 1991. That compelled me to go there and have a look for myself. I found that most of what we were hearing was based upon the testimony of defectors. There was very little independent observation on the ground. And I wanted to go and see Iraq for myself, also because I felt that ever since 1991 that there would be inevitably another war between the United States and Iraq.
You say you wanted to understand the phenomenon of Saddam Hussein, to witness his tyranny and understand what made it work.
That's right. For some time, I've been fascinated with the exercise of power, and I have often written profiles of figures, dictators of one sort or another, Pinochet of Chile, Charles Taylor of Liberia. And Saddam inhabited that realm as well. But so much of what I knew was difficult to verify or substantiate, and I wanted to see it for myself. And so I tried to go with a clean slate, as much as that's ever possible. And I spent time in Iraq, and indeed found it to be one of the most controlled environments I'd ever worked in. I concluded after my journey there, where I had actually quite good access. It was a time when not many people were reporting on Iraq, and I got close to people. I was able to have access to people very close to Saddam Hussein. He himself lived this clandestine virtual life and didn't come out of hiding, but I spoke to people very close to him. I wanted to understand his psychology and that of the country in which he'd almost reshaped in his own image. I came away convinced that it was probably the most terrifying dictatorship I had ever witnessed. And the reason for that was because no one spoke, or even rarely even mentioned his name. The level of fear was so great that absolutely no one broke silence. But it remained a fascinating conundrum to me for that very reason. How could it be that an entire nation could not speak? And so, in a sense, there began my ongoing exploration to try to find out what was in people's hearts and minds, and I intensified that search as the war last year approached.
It's interesting. You write that people gave you clues sometimes that, you know, they there were things that they didn't say that kind of made it obvious what they were saying, but they couldn't say out loud.
That's right.
And for example, you're driving by some of the palaces that he erected for himself, and people couldn't even actually look at the palaces.
That's right. I had a minder assigned to me whom I got quite close to, but even he never truly broke silence. And what was the most amazing thing about Saddam's Iraq was that these huge, vast, immense palaces were absolutely everywhere, as well as his image. It was the only graven image in public in the country, in fact. You know, massive statues and so on, which I think a lot of Americans have are now used to having seen the images of. But nonetheless, when you were there, it was quite extraordinary. There was not a place you could be in public in Baghdad without, at the corner of your eye somewhere, there would be a portrait or a statue of Saddam looking at you. But these palaces were vast, and we would be in the car chattering away, and he'd be pointing out this and that to me, and suddenly we'd come alongside this huge, brooding, massive palace with, you know, a mosque-like minareted machine gun nests at the gates, or Saddam on prancing stallions in bronze, and he would fall silent. And sometimes we would go on for, you know, hundreds of meters. These places are vast. And I eventually adopted the habit of goading him by saying, "What's that?" And he would get very irritated and would always say the same thing: "It's a presidential guest house." And later I realized that, you know, he was simply terrified. He couldn't speak. Once I was with him, and I was looking at the pylons and cranes of this great mosque that Saddam was hoping to build to be the greatest in the world after the great mosque of Mecca. And I took out a little camera I carried to take a picture, and he begged me not to. He said, no, it's forbidden. He said, "It's not only forbidden, we can't even discuss it. You're not supposed to see it." And I said, "What do you mean? You and I can actually look at it and see it, but we have to pretend it's not there." And he nodded his head, absolutely. And I could see from the tenseness on his face that he was deadly serious.
Before the war, you interviewed a number of people, including some Iraqi exiles in Iran and others. And a number of people you talked with said Iraqis would be very glad if America toppled Saddam, but would quickly turn against America if there was an occupation.
That's right. I went to Iran precisely to speak with Iraqis who could speak. And there were hundreds of thousands that had been living in exile for years, people who'd fled Saddam's depredations, most of them following the Gulf War, who had been forced out in one of his purges of ethnic Persian Iraqis. And I found amongst them, it was fascinating and rather sobering, because although these were arguably amongst the most abused victims of Saddam, most had lost family members, been tortured themselves, spent years in prison, they were not jubilant about the prospect of the American invasion. And the reason for that was because there was no pronouncement about a subsequent game plan in Iraq. There was no message coming out from the White House that this was simply a war of liberation and they would leave, leaving most Iraqis to conclude that America planned to occupy the country and had ulterior motives in its war. So there was no sense that America was coming on a mercy mission. And most people said they recognized the war was inevitable. They said, "If you must come, come, do it quickly and leave. Don't make the mistake of staying in Iraq and getting bogged down in the shifting sands of Iraq. Iraqis are very nice people, but they're very proud of their country. They do not like to be occupied by foreign troops. They will fight you. You must leave quickly. Don't attempt to follow through with these ambitions to remake the Middle East in the American image, to create a great democracy. Do something pragmatic and go. It will be bad for America if they stay." And I've often, and I have to say, it resonated very much with my own growing perceptions and feeling of disquiet about, again, the lack of any future date of departure of American troops, this notion that America was coming to occupy a nation about which it knew very little, concerned me very much. And it caused me to look to the recent past. I say recent because Iraq has a very long past. So many Iraqis brought up the 1920 Arab revolt against the British occupiers to me that I began looking into that experience. And I saw that only two generations ago, the British, who came as liberators again to dislodge the Ottoman Turks in World War I, tried to stay on in the country and found themselves engulfed in bloodshed as both Sunni and Shia tribes rose up against them, joined forces, and made their lives miserable. It was a very catastrophic experience, the British occupation of Iraq, but it had been almost airbrushed out of history as our nations walked back into war in 2003.
Mm-hmm. And you say that in particular seemed to be on the mind of every other Iraqi you spoke with. I doubt if 1 out of 10 of Americans even knows about this. history.
Well, that's right. That's right. Not only that, I was I began asking after the war and the American military began spreading out in the country, and as they began to meet resistance, precisely the kind of attacks and resistance that so many Iraqis had forewarned of, I often sought out the officers to ask them if they had ever had any sort of briefing sessions, history lessons, you know, even the some of those sort of military with a chalkboard and the battlefield of 1920 in Iraq, which I would have imagined they might have gone through as part of their prep before coming to Iraq. And I met with one colonel in particular, a young guy, West Point, very bright, pointed out to me as one of the best and the brightest. And I asked, and he was in charge of Fallujah at the time, which was the early flashpoint and remains the worst. And he was talking to me about winning hearts and minds and teaching people democracy 101 and how he regarded Fallujah as a success story and all of this. This was in the summer of 2003. And finally I said to him, by the way, were you aware that Fallujah was this area right here where you are, was where the Arab Revolt of 1920 really took heart against the British? And were you aware of that history when you came? Did you have any kind of history lesson? And he paused and looked rather mortified and said, no, there wasn't time. We didn't. And then he said, but I've picked up a couple of books, and he picked up one he had in the corner. He said, I'm trying to read it in my spare time. I don't have a lot of spare time. In other words, amnesia. They came without any real sense of the past. It was as though the Gulf War of 1991 was the only starting point for the American history in Iraq, in the Americans' minds.
We have a caller to talk with, and I hate to make them wait much longer. I certainly have a lot of questions myself, but I will defer to callers if people would like to join us. Let me mention again that we're talking during this hour, Focus 580, with John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker, about his book, The Fall of Baghdad, just published by the Penguin Press. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so by calling us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a Champaign listener on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, you said that you were fascinated by the exercise of power, so I thought I'd ask you to elaborate more on that. You did talk about Saddam Hussein to some extent, and I was just wondering if, you know, you can talk, you know, freestyle, but about this history of the exercise of power in Iraq and how that may or may not have influenced Saddam Hussein's exercise of power. Did he have outside influences or historical influences? Influenced by the Ottomans or the Germans or Stalin? And then also, what about Chalabi and Alawi and the CPA and Brenner and the neocons?
That's a small question there.
Okay, I'll see how much I can address and digest. It's interesting. Saddam very much was a student of Joseph Stalin when he was in prison in the early 60s. After being essentially a thug who rose within the party, having earned notoriety and fame by having attempted to kill the prime minister of the country and then fleeing, he studied and read Isaac Deutscher's biography of Stalin several times in a row. I know this from someone who knew, who was a Ba'athist and who knew Saddam in those days, and was extremely influenced by him, to the extent that he built an apparatus, a command economy, where everything stemmed and came back to the state with an all-pervasive party and intelligence apparatus. His hallmark bloodlettings, very similar to Stalin's own purges, of his own party, first of all, to cement his personal power base, and then followed up with purges of various groups, targeted assassinations, as well as butcheries, which traumatized and made passive certain population groups that caused him problems. A lot of his modus operandi appears to have been both to have stemmed from his admiration of the way Stalin effectively exercised his iron grip over the Soviet Union. And also he took inspiration from great figures of the Mesopotamian, the pre-Iraqi past, Nebuchadnezzar, Salahuddin the Magnificent, who drove the Crusaders from Jerusalem. And, of course, the wars in those days were both epic and barbaric. Huge numbers of civilians were generally killed in the battles of those days. And really, when you look at Saddam and his own epic reign and the way he fought his wars, he fought them very much like a Khan or a vizier or a dictator of yesteryear. He was almost a throwback to the days of Herod or Nebuchadnezzar. And he very much saw himself as part of this great Mesopotamian epic, this ongoing epic sweep of history in which the cradle of civilization, Iraq, proud Iraq, would be resurgent and would be the ruler of the Arab world, would defeat the Zionist entity, as he referred to Israel, and the Persians as well. I think that the Saddam's brutality and to a certain extent has created a pathology in Iraq, which almost any new ruler must address until Iraqis have confronted their pathology. I suppose it's analogous to that of an abusive child who has grown up and spent many years with an abusive parent. Being a victim doesn't make for nice people necessarily. The Iraqis have never had a chance to confront their rage and frustration, their sense of humiliation over their victimization by Saddam, and also by the fact that he made them the handmaidens to their own oppression. They were informing on each other. Certain communities stood by passively while he massacred others. He played on the sectarian sentiments of the group, of the various communities. And so I think that's why we see in Alawi, the new American handpicked leader of the country, an attempt to appear to be assertive and even brutal. He makes jokes about it. There was a story when I was last in Iraq this summer about him executing personally six prisoners. He denied them, but did so with a chuckle. He very much liked the fact that this story was out there. And indeed, around Baghdad, the response by most Iraqis I questioned on it was, well, if he did, good. We need someone who's strong. There is a sense that only strength and brute strength will stop them from the chaos, which has overtaken Iraq since the arrival of the Americans.
I hope that gets at some of the caller's question. We have another caller waiting, and we're already almost at our half point here. There's so much that I'd like to try to cover, but anyway, we'll go next to another caller in Champaign County, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Talking about amnesia, I think one of the things that should be pointed out in this context, the influences on Saddam, is that the U.S. was pivotal in his rise to power. This is why Iraqis are kind of suspicious of American intentions, it seems to me. We were collaborating. We were providing, the U.S. was providing intelligence data, aerial photographs, probably around the time when Halabja happened. And the receipts, Dr. Germ still apparently has the receipts for some of her biological purchases. You mentioned the New Yorker as a great source hosted in the introduction. I don't know if the guest actually heard that, but I had to take issue with that because I think there was some amnesia in the early reporting. The Jeffrey Weinberg article on Halabja managed to ignore the U.S. role in the whole thing at the time, and it seems to me that this is also what the U.S. population doesn't know about. And when people are wondering why there is such hatred and such reaction, this is part of the story. And after the Gulf War, when the U.S. Didn't encouraged an uprising and then didn't aid one, that's when a lot of the mass graves were actually.
Well, you're right. Let me just jump in because absolutely true. There's a story that that most Americans are probably unaware of. I don't see why they are, but apparently they are unaware of, which is that, you know, yes, Saddam did have weapons of mass destruction, and he used them to great consequence in the 1980s, both in poison gas attacks against his Kurdish population and against the Iranians in the long Iran-Iraq war. And it was precisely during that time that Western companies were supplying him with the means to obtain those chemical weapons. This is not a political tirade. It is factually substantiated. Our present defense secretary visited Saddam Hussein twice in Baghdad during that period. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians were killed in the battlefields. And whenever the Iranians made headway on the battlefield, we began providing him with AWACS, aerial intelligence, showing the troop concentrations of the Iranian forces, whereupon he launched devastating artillery and rocket attacks on them, and including poison gas attacks. So precisely at the time that Saddam was using weapons of mass destruction, we were covertly and not so covertly allied with him in all but name, in all but there was never a public expression of support, but it was in the zeitgeist, and it was very much happening on the ground. It was, and then again after the 1991 uprising, which followed the Gulf War, and the decision by President Bush not to unseat Saddam from power, our troops were still on the ground in Iraq while, in essence, we allowed him to counterattack, to carry out the vast butchery throughout the south of Iraq, where the people had risen up against him. And many of the mass graves we've seen the images of being uncovered in the past year and a half are filled with the bodies of people that were murdered precisely in those weeks. So, indeed, that is one of the reasons why there was not a great sense of jubilation and quite a bit of anxiety amongst the exiles and the refugees I spoke with in the weeks and months before the 2003 war, because they had this history. They were aware of America's history in the past. And there was never a public relations effort, to say the least, by the United States to overcome those feelings of dread, those feelings of bitterness, those feelings of cynicism about American intentions in Iraq, which is one of the great problems we face.
A curious thing that isn't common in much from the Kerry-Bush debate that struck me very hard was his comment that we should clearly say we have no intentions to stay, and he even questioned the idea of these bases that are going up, 14 bases, some of them already constructed and some of them still under construction, one of them on the Syrian border. And clearly...
Well, it's very important that America, I mean, this is one of the problems we've had, and why it's one of the things that has fueled the insurgency is this mixed messages that have come out of the White House about our intentions there. And I mean, it's almost inconceivable the colossal nature of the blunders, assuming that was the plan, i.e. to take over Iraq or to democratize and afterwards invade Iran and Syria. The blunders that were made, tactically speaking, have been just extraordinary, because not only did they not send enough troops, they never protected the borders. And if Iran and Syria felt threatened, and they certainly do, they have either looked the other way or absolutely cooperated with the inflow of people wishing to do battle with the Americans ever since. To this date, the borders are not secured, but we are, as you say, building what appear to be permanent military bases in the country. And Iraqis, like most people, are proud of their nation and feel humiliated and emasculated by the presence of foreign troops. If whether it was President Bush or a future President Kerry were able to say, we intend to leave your country, we have no long-term designs on your country, we would like to make good on the fact that we are there, we would like to rebuild, we would like to do this and this, and by this date, we will leave your country. There will be no foreign troops left in your country as of X date. That is very important. That's a very important message to send. But during this entire administration, during the last 16 months, no such statement has come out of this White House, and I think it's one of the greatest causes for the suspicion and the continued fighting in Iraq.
On the contrary, that the time certain leaving was attacked as being, you know, antithetical to quote unquote victory. I wanted to make an analogy to Vietnam, and the one that I'd like to make is that there was some sort of after action report on Vietnam, and it showed that 30% of the puppet government in Saigon was actually supportive of the ouster of the U.S. And it just seems to me that, particularly with some evidence from this Canadian military writer, I forget his name at this point, but he was captured in Tal Afar, which is a Shiite Turkmen region. And it just staggers me that there's such a complexity of cultures where Turkmens, who you would expect to be Sunni, are actually Shiite. But he was captured very easily by some sort of insurgent group there because the people that were in the U.S.-provided military uniforms, who were nominally the Free Iraqi Force, actually just escorted them to them, this couple. And it's clear to me that that kind of mixed loyalties and...
There's a great deal of mixed loyalty going on. I mean, even the coalition partners, many of the mainstream political parties with whom the United States has brokered a kind of tactical alliance and are not fighting or urging their people to fight the Americans, wish the Americans to leave. They are very much tactical partners. And as for the wholesale recruitment of people in this need to have to rebuild a security presence, having disbanded the former army ill-advisedly in that sweeping way in May 2003, a lot of people that want to carry out espionage or sabotage operations within the new security forces are, of course, volunteering as well. We've seen a number of cases where arrests have been made of senior commanders of the Iraqi Defense Forces because they are collaborating with the people fighting them and fighting the Americans. So it's the Americans are operating in a serious intelligence vacuum in Iraq. I mean, the bombings this morning occurred right outside the Green Zone wall, and they continue. And it's a daily event now. What Americans should be aware of is that when they hear of these things, is that now hang on. Aren't we occupying the capital of Baghdad? Don't we control it? Where are our troops? Well, they're behind those walls. They're sitting in armored vehicles. And the streets immediately around the Green Zone are being operated in with impunity by the insurgents. Huge swatches of the capital are now no-go areas. And that's 16 months into an American military occupation. It's they do not know what's going on. And they are incapable of preventing attacks. That's why they take place every day.
We're talking this morning with John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker, discussing his new book, The Fall of Baghdad. And we have several callers waiting. And I wanted to just ask a couple of questions about the experience you witnessed. I mean, there's so many great stories in the book. I don't even know where to begin, actually. But the issue that I want to ask you to talk about is when the Americans did arrive in Baghdad, how they conducted themselves, how they interacted with the Iraqi people in Baghdad, and then the beginning of the looting and what was the response at that point by the American forces.
Well, the Americans arrived with very few men, and I mean, I watched them arrive in northern Baghdad where looting had begun, and these young men who'd been traveling all night in these armored personnel carriers suddenly emerged from their vehicles. I was watching, bleary-eyed. They didn't know where they were, and they asked me where they were. I told them. And within minutes, their first duties were to control the flow of traffic. The only traffic on the road were hundreds, and soon it was thousands, of looters emerging from the buildings that they were plundering on the avenue in front of us. And within a few hours, those buildings were on fire. There were gunfights taking place. By the next day, the looting had spread to right down to downtown Baghdad, the soldiers appeared to be incapable of stopping the looting and clearly had no orders to. In the beginning, in the first few hours, there was this air of sort of happiness, the, you know, happy looters. The people were saying Bush good, Saddam bad, and these young soldiers and Marines didn't know any better, and assumed that this was just, they were just attacking the institutions of Saddam's power. But there was clearly different things going on. I watched as a special American unit came and protected the oil ministry, set up an ambush, just as the first looters were beginning to loot that building and carry out the sofas from the foyer. But they did not protect the buildings on either side, which included the trade and the commerce ministry, the warehouses, the Olympic Committee, the education ministry, all of which were absolutely plundered and then burned. And increasingly, as the days went on, it was clear that the plundering was a large scale. It was almost industrial looting going on, and some of it was sabotage and appeared to be by members of the old regime, groups of whom were still fighting in different parts of the city. On the second day after the fall of Baghdad, I realized that the hospitals were being looted as well, and that Americans had not offered any protection to these. I happened to visit one where I had a friend working. It was the only hospital remaining in Baghdad. The foyer was full of dead and wounded people. And my friend, the doctor, emerged from the emergency room where he'd been working 36 hours straight, all bloody, and begged me to bring Marines to guard the hospital. I did so. I managed to find the commander of the Marines. He was unaware that the hospitals were being looted. I could see this from his expression. He was surprised. We got a map out of the city, and he did not know where the hospital district was. And eventually I led a group of Marines to this hospital, which was being surrounded by looters. They were armed, there was gunfights going on, and they did protect that hospital. Later on, I spoke with the military men about that period, because I think it was key to the loss of the aura of invincibility, of the American military power that had been established during the bombing of Baghdad. The Iraqi people were prepared to do what the Americans wanted. They went from applauding the troops to cursing them within hours of their arrival because they allowed the city to be pillaged, and as well as many of their hallowed institutions like the National Museum, the National Library with sacred old texts, and so on. And they knew that the people who wanted to fight the Americans were plundering arsenals right under their noses. So the Americans not only lost the respect of the many Iraqis who were prepared to go along passively with their occupation, but also the people who were being displaced by the Americans lost their fear of them, because they realized that the Americans were operating without any intelligence. If they could rob an armory and get away with it and the Americans didn't know about it, it meant the Americans really didn't know what they were doing, and that's exactly what happened. So it was I had no real expectation of anything other than a kind of complete collapse of the regime once it was clear that there was not going to be a prolonged siege of Baghdad, which was the first thing that we all believed was going to happen, because this was Saddam's plan. We thought it was going to be very bloody in Baghdad. It was very strange how everything melted away. And in retrospect, it seems clear that there was some kind of plan not to stand and fight, but to melt away and come back. And the Americans seemingly walked into this as much as, in the old cowboy movies, a group of cavalry guys go into a canyon and get ambushed by Indians. It was a very naive thing to do, and they mishandled things immediately. If they had established a curfew very quickly and secured the city, I think things could have been different. And there was a series of other judgments made along the way that fueled this. But this is not a war that was inevitable. There would have been problems, yes. This is entirely as a result of bad political decisions and serious errors of judgment made along the way. It did not have to happen this way.
We have some other calls to talk with. Let's talk with them. Another Indiana listener next, line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. I appreciate your comments on what a terrible dictator that Saddam Hussein was, because a lot of times in our current media and press, we kind of get the impression that he really wasn't that bad a guy, and I appreciate you talking about how he's one of the worst dictators that has ever been alive. And I also am very upset with your characterization of our military as being a bunch of idiots walking into Baghdad and talking about how you yourself thought there'd be a big bloody fight, and then you come out and say, well, they were stupid, they were idiots, and I'm very upset with this.
Okay.
Sorry, I never called anybody an idiot.
I was going to make that point.
Nor did I call them stupid. I said that, and nor have I, in any way, I don't think, made any statements of disrespect for the soldiers on the ground. These are mostly young men. They had fought long and hard. They had every expectation of being greeted as liberators in Iraq, and it was the result of political judgments and political decisions made well above them that they were forced to implement or not to implement, as the case may be, that brought about this situation. I have every respect for the actual soldiers on the ground. My criticism is directed at people above and beyond those soldiers. So please get that straight.
Okay. Hope that gets to the caller's point there. We'll go next to a Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Getting back to the Iraqi view of the American occupation, very little is being said today about the really quite open praise of empire by the neocons prior to the war. And immediately afterward, not thinking of, I believe his name was Friedman, his article in The Atlantic, which was a very open exposition in favor of the second century Roman Empire and the 18th century British Empire. And then there were various writings and pronouncements by Richard Perle, to a lesser extent, Wolfowitz. How can they have any expectation that we are going to leave?
Well, yes, of course. This is part of the problem. Not only did, I mean, it seems, that's why I was saying, I think it was, if anything, it was a tactical error to announce these sort of ambitions, if indeed you were hoping to carry them out. Because I remember having several conversations in Iran the month before the war in which people very close to the ruling clergy there said to me, and I looked through the notes again and again because they were so prescient. They said, look, your leaders seem to be, their minds seem to be taken over by Armageddon. They are going to make this war in Iraq. It is not in our interest as a nation. But since it's going to happen, it is in our interest to make sure that you become bogged down there. We do not want you coming here. This may well be, you know, the worst decision the Americans could possibly make. And they said, you know, we hope that Iraq, we do not like Saddam. We would like to see him go, but we do not want to see Americans next door because they have said they want to come here. So, you know, we will do our best to see that you bogged down there. Now, what that has translated into, I don't know. But, you know, I felt as though I was sitting with very savvy poker players standing in for the man who had already showed them his hand, if you know what I mean. They were almost licking their chops at the prospect of the Americans blundering in as they were preparing to do. But indeed, I think we will have a reckoning about this belated, nakedly open philosophy of imperialism that seemed to take purchase in people's minds in policymaking circles following September 11th and trying to implement it on the back of Iraq.
Even for those Iraqis who are not maybe inclined to, you know, sort of a political reading in that sense, you know, what's on the minds of Paul Wolfowitz, for example. The American pretext for invading Iraq was to disarm Saddam of weapons of mass destruction, but of course none have been found. And I guess I'm wondering, how do ordinary Iraqis feel about that? Does that play into their analysis of the situation.
The fact that, I mean, you know, politicians usually drag that out as the first stone in their quiver, you know, in an argument about the perfidy of the Americans. But in fact, for the average Iraqis, it's a moot point. They're dealing with a fait accompli. I mean, the average Iraqi would be happy that the Americans sort things out and leave as soon as possible. You know, they had every expectation of a new life. They were, many Iraqis were, even Baathists were fed up with Saddam and hoping that you know, Iraq would become like Dallas or something. There was a hard core, of course, that were going to be displaced, and were going to fight. But that hard core became much larger with some of the judgments made afterwards to sweepingly ban all Baathists from public life, to disband the entire army. You know, one in every four Iraqis had a family member in the armed forces and depended on that salary. Most of them were fairly apolitical, as well as many Baathists. They were civil servants. They ran the country. For the average Iraqis, the question whether or not there was weapons of mass destruction isn't really a moot point. They're quite cynical about, you know, most Iraqis believe that America is there for their oil. And you can sit down and have quite reasonable conversations, and they'll say, look, it's fine. America's here because of our oil. Okay. You take 70%, but leave us with 30. Saddam didn't leave us with any. But if America will take 70% of our oil, but just let 30% or 10% stay here in Iraq, that will be good enough for us. People say things like that in sort of good humor, cynical good humor. They don't understand the way it all works. They don't understand that America will buy the oil. They think we are there simply stealing it. But even that they're prepared to live with as long as there's peace and they can... their families can be safe and their children can be educated and they can have a piece of the action. We've done a very bad public relations job in terms of explaining to Iraqis of various levels what our true intentions are. And the original sin lies precisely in that imperial discourse which began emanating out of Washington before the war. You're right.
We have another call to talk with. Let's do that. A listener in Rantoul on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I think there's two things. I mean, first off, the battle plans for Gulf War One, and then battle plans for Gulf War Two, which were Operation Blue Devil. I mean, that, you know, that started back in the mid-90s. The other thing that I think what we're forgetting and what has a direct impact is the horrendous casualty count as a result of the sanctions. Gulf War One, when we destroyed all the chemical and biologic munitions, and then the continued operations to this day. And just my own conversation with the Iraqis and the leaders, that's one of the major things that has an impact on looking at what the U.S. intentions are. And I was just wondering what the guests' thoughts are on that.
Are you speaking about the depleted uranium, that kind of thing?
Well, we've got the depleted uranium, but then we destroyed all the chemical and biological munitions and the sanctions. So, you know, I mean, the World Health Organization had looked at...
Yes,
you know, upwards of a quarter of a, you know, over a million and a half to 2 million as a result of the sanctions in the hospitals to this day. When you look at Ali Ali's reports out of Basra,
yeah,
just a disaster.
Oh yeah, I mean it really is. I traveled between Basra and the Kuwait border late 2002, where the doctors had told me that the leukemia rates were huge amongst the farmers and people living there, and they were still living there, producing the food because they had nowhere else to grow it, and it was being sold into the markets. I'd visited the leukemia wards of the hospital, which, you know, apparently the numbers of infantile leukemia had quintupled or something like that since the Gulf War. And, of course, this became a very politically inflammatory and volatile issue, and everybody loads their figures one way or another. But it seemed to me that there was good ground for this argument that depleted uranium had affected, our armor-piercing shells used, inaugurated, I guess, in the Gulf War and used extensively in that war and left around the country, had indeed caused cancer rates to rise. And this was an issue that was not being addressed or being stymied. But the World Health Organization and UN and others talked about it with great concern and gave great credence to this possibility, but it was being ignored by our political class. And then, of course, the sanctions. I mean, I think quite beyond the effect on malnutrition or whatever. I mean, in fact, Iraq was is a country where there was a lot of food. Yes, there were many poor people. In fact, people living miserably. But a lot of, you know, a lot of that was as a result of Saddam's rule rather than sanctions. You noticed it when you went to the south. Basra was miserable because Saddam never poured any resources into the place. But the markets had food. People did not starve. The money of the country had gone into war material rather than medicines and schools. But the sanctions didn't help. Doctors complained to me about the inability to get, for instance, X-ray machines because it was classified as nuclear medicine. And because Saddam had wanted to build a nuclear bomb, he wasn't allowed any radiology equipment. So they were forced to smuggle it in, or not at all. And people like me were brought to see the dying children and in the hopes that it would help them win the propaganda war. So it was all very cynical. I think that for me, the most dismaying thing about visiting Saddam's Iraq and Iraq under sanctions was the stark realization that 13 years after the Gulf War, there was a new generation of Iraqis who had seen nothing palpably benign from our country. Nothing. We exercise no positive influence in Iraq whatsoever. The only thing we did was overfly the country and occasionally bomb radar installations. And occasionally civilians would die. And we gave the country back to Saddam to stir the pot against everything we were doing and really did not engage in the battle to win Iraqis' hearts and minds. And then in March 2003 decided we would go to war with the country again and expect it to be greeted as heroes and liberators. And of course, it didn't happen.
We have one caller I'll squeeze in real fast. We only have a minute or two left. Listener Champagne, good morning.
Hello. In reference to your Iraqi friend who said, leave us 30% of the oil, there may have been a bit of irony there. He probably was aware of, after the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, the British and Americans took 80% and only left 20% of the oil for the Iranians. Just a brief comment.
Right. Well, that's right. They base a great deal of their worldview and their on the assumption that, you know, they are a prize, a piece of booty to be raped and plundered. I mean, Saddam, their own tyrant, did it to them. And they knew that the British had, you know, formed the Anglo-Persian Oil Corporation not long after their occupation began, and that oil was one of their interests. And, of course, they're very aware that oil is one of the Americans' key interests. They don't really know how the oil economy works, but they noticed that the oil ministry was guarded while the rest of the ministries of Baghdad were allowed to be plundered. And they are aware, as most, I think, Americans aren't, that if there's one part of the Iraqi economy that is working, albeit with sabotage, which causes leaks and so on, is the oil. The oil has been getting pumped regularly since the very early days. It was one of the first parts of the Iraq's infrastructure to be put back on stream. So you can understand why there's a certain amount of cynicism. Your point's well taken.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we're out of time, and we're going to have to leave it there. We have barely scratched the surface of the stories in the book. The Fall of Baghdad is the title. The author has been our guest, John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker. So if you'd like to learn more, it'd be an excellent way to go, and you can pick up that book in bookstores. I'm sure it is published by the Penguin Press. Also, mention real briefly that since Chicago is in our listening area, John Lee Anderson will be in Chicago at the Borders on Michigan Avenue on the 14th of October. That's a week from this Thursday, so you have a chance to meet him there as well. And to you, John Lee Anderson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.